From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
The beast in me is caged by frail and fragile bars, restless by day and by night, rants and rages at the stars. God help the beast in me.
The appeal to ruining people was a sort of an intimacy with people.
Violence devours all it touches, its voracious appetite rarely fulfilled. Yet violence doesn't only destroy, it creates and molds as well.
We're so inured to death, we're so inured to violence, we're so inured to serial killers, that I needed to jolt you out of that.
God help the beast in me.
What is it with America's obsession with serial killers? I mean, who would have predicted the popularity of Dexter, the TV show about the hunky guy who really knows what to do with a chainsaw? And this season, the networks are adding 7 new shows about serial killers. Of course, we're all horrified when mass murder's real, at Sandy Hook Elementary School, or a Colorado movie theater, or the Boston Marathon. But does watching serial killers encourage more of them in real life? In this hour, how evil are we anyway? We'll meet Lauren Bucus, author of The Shining Girls. It's a novel about a serial killer who travels through time to murder bright young women. And neurophilosopher Patricia Churchland answers the question, is genocide in our genes? And Chuck Klosterman grapples with real and not-so-real villains. But first, Emmy Thomas. That is not actually her real name. She used a pseudonym to write her book Confessions of a Sociopath, A Life Spent Hiding in Plain Sight. As you can tell from the title, Thomas is a diagnosed sociopath. She's one of the 4% of highly successful, non-criminal sociopaths that make up the U.S. population. Anne Strangechamps talked with her.
Emmy, when did you first become aware that you were different from other people? Do you feel like this is something you've always known?
I think I always thought that I was different, but I didn't really think sociopath, obviously. When I was little, I thought maybe I'm just smart, maybe I'm just Mormon, maybe it's something having to do with my big family, big musical family. Maybe there are other things that are sort of idiosyncratic about me that are just chance. And I don't think I really realized how systematic my differences were or what their particular nature were until law school. When we were all trained to think like lawyers, very logically and rationally, and my classmates and I did that well, and we did it pretty much in lockstep and did it in similar ways until we started talking about controversial subjects like the death penalty or abortion. And then my classmates would have emotional reactions to these things, and there was an emotional component to their argument, and they had feelings about these particular issues, not just rational think like a lawyer thoughts about them. And I didn't. And I thought, these people are having these very authentic reactions. I'm not having them. I must be very different from them.
People have a lot of stereotypes about what it means to be a sociopath. And one of them is that sociopaths have no feelings or don't empathize with other people. You open the book with this kind of chilling story about, I think you were a teenager maybe, and a baby possum fell into your pool one day. Could you tell that story?
Yeah. So I had planned to do swimming lessons in the pool, and I walked out and was getting everything set, kickboards ready, and then I noticed there was splashing in the pool, and I got close enough to see that it was a baby possum, and I thought, well, we can't have swimming lessons in the pool with a baby possum. We have to get it out somehow. So in my mind, I thought the best, easiest way and the most risk-free way was to kill it, to help it drown, essentially. And then after it's dead, to get it out. Because who knows? You know, you take it out and does it bite you? Does it have rabies? It just didn't seem like the benefits of trying to fish it out outweighed the potential cost.
So you just approached it purely rationally.
Yeah.
when I did that, I didn't really think this is like a cruel thing to do or I'm enjoying killing this animal. It was purely this practical thing to do. And it was only in the retelling of it to other people did I realize that other people would have approached it very differently, you know, and would have had feelings of guilt almost at killing it. And I think feelings of guilt, I mean, it's a pest, right? It's a pest in the sense that it is an animal that's where it shouldn't be. And we kill animals like that all the time. You know, we have rat traps and we put down wild dogs. We just do this, right? But other people, their feelings about it are a lot more complicated than mine are, obviously.
So when you told that story to other people, did they kind of gasp and say, oh my God, why? Why did you do that?
Exactly. I was surprised that they were having these reactions. You know, that's another example of that happened in my like late teens, early 20s or something, of realizing that you're different. I thought it was almost not a story worth telling. Maybe I just told it on the offhand, like, why didn't you have swimming lessons today? Oh, I canceled them because there was an opossum in the pool that I tried to drown, but it didn't drown quick enough.
So what do you think is responsible for you being a sociopath?
Well, it's very hard to say. And, you know, I'm very careful to say always I'm a diagnosed sociopath. Who even knows what sociopathy means? I don't think there's nearly enough research to make any sort of for sure statements. But the research that has been done suggests that there's a genetic component. They've done twin studies and found that twins, you know, if one's a sociopath, the other one's much more likely to also be a sociopath. Most people's guess is it's about 50% genetic or 50% sort of inborn, and the rest comes from other sources, environmental, I guess. I would say, you know, if I had to trace the genetic link, it would come from my father's birth father, who abandoned him as a baby, knocked up my grandmother, shotgun wedding, abandoned. And we don't know that much about him because he never met the father, never knew him at all. But we do know that he was very sort of violent, aggressive, had maybe a mood disorder. He had a bunch of scars on his face from all the reckless activities he would engage in. And he ended up losing his money by buying a ranch. He fancied himself a cowboy and then ran the ranch into the ground. Mm. So if I had a guess, I would say he is the source of the genetics. Mm.
So once you got that diagnosis, and by now you write in the book that you identify more as a sociopath than by your gender or profession or race. Can you talk more about that? What does that mean to you?
Yeah, it doesn't actually mean that I identify so strongly with being a sociopath. It largely means I don't identify with the other things. And I think one of the primary characteristics of sociopaths, what it feels like to be a sociopath, is to have a very weak sense of self. There's sort of no there. I don't think of myself in these terms, female or part of a particular political party, or, you know, even my age, my ethnicity, even Mormonism to a certain extent. I've never really felt Mormon. So people see me and see all these different characteristics and treat me that way, but I never really think of myself in those terms. I think of myself more in terms of how I process things, how I think, rather than the results. So more like the formula rather than the particular inputs or the outputs of the formula.
But that's interesting that you say you don't have a sense of self. That's just such an interesting concept. For one thing, you must understand something about a sense of self to know that you don't have one.
Right.
How did you figure out what you were missing?
That's a good question. You know, not having a sense of self, what does it feel like? It sort of feels like I am a mirror or a camera. You know, I am just capturing other things. I think the figuring out that I didn't have a sense of self was experiencing things like the law school experience, where people had very strong opinions. And I always felt like the opinions I had were largely convenient. I had them for that particular context or for that particular moment, or maybe even just to portray a particular role in society, whatever I was doing. And I always thought I can change my mind the very next minute. So I think probably actually in my relationships, my personal relationships, is where it felt most obvious, because I felt that way. You know, I say this all the time, that tomorrow I could be out of a relationship if I happen to be in a relationship, that I make a decision to be whoever I am or whatever role that I have every day, make a decision to keep my job every day. I feel like I could quit every day. Same thing with relationships, same thing with everything that I participate in. I think I can move tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Constantly, I'm deciding these things. It's not something that's rigid or solid. I think that really scares people when they're in a relationship with me because it doesn't seem secure.
Well, you also write that one of your favorite pastimes is what you call the fine art of ruining people, which you describe as inserting yourself in someone else's psyche and quietly wreaking as much havoc as you can. For example.
Well, yeah, favorite pastimes. I mean, I think that might be overstating it a little bit. I say in the book, it's sort of a delicacy that I engage in as often as I eat foie gras, which is, I mean, I haven't eaten foie gras in for forever. And ruining people, too. It's something that I did more before I was diagnosed and, you know, wasn't really aware of the consequences of some of my actions. But the appeal to ruining people was sort of an intimacy with people. I really like people. I actually do really like people, but it has been hard. You know, as I said, with relationships and other things, it's been hard to have any sort of sense of intimacy with people, emotional, physical, anything. And I think ruining people in some ways was just a way to interact with people. You know, it's like the difference between hugging somebody and roughhousing with them, punching them. They can mean the same thing, actually. They can both mean affection or you want to engage with that particular thing. And so ruining people was almost like an emotional roughhousing.
What's an example? How have you ruined someone?
It's not like they actually are ruined. That's the biggest point, I guess, to make first, is they don't end up, you know, a shell of their former selves. It's just a mind game, basically. You try to get in their mind. You try to get them to like you, get them to sort of rely on you for particular things. You get them to wonder what your motives are. You're just playing mind games with them. It's like seducing them. Probably in a way, except the goal is not to, you know, be in a relationship with them or get them to do particular things. You just want to inhabit their mind. You want them to think of you and wonder what you think about.
You tell the story about this young, successful lawyer, Morgan, for instance, who by the time you finished your relationship with her, you said she had been young and successful, and by the end she was an anorexic who'd lost her job and involved in substance abuse. That sounds like ruining.
Yeah, you know, Morgan, we're actually still friends, Morgan and I. I wouldn't take credit for those things. I do think that she, and this is something that I've kind of adapted over the years to seek after people who have sort of masochistic tendencies. For whatever reason, they're wanting to self-destruct or their life is unstable. And so I become a part of that. I don't necessarily lead them to do those things. Those were her choices, but her vulnerability and her instability, I think, attracted me because it was so easy to kind of get into her head. But I don't think she would think of me as a negative influence in her life, actually. You know, if anything, I've sort of been a stabilizing influence or at least an interesting influence. She wants to engage in these sorts of things. And most people would really judge her for that sort of behavior and think you're ruining your life and how could you? And we're not going to support you anymore. And we're, you know, I'm going to stop being your friend because I just can't see you do this to yourself. And I was always supportive of whatever she chose to do. So
you've written that your view of morality is instrumental.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
I think I don't really have this emotional view of morality. It's largely ethically based. It's largely utilitarian. To the extent I have raised in the Mormon church and taught to serve others and that raised in a large family, I was able to see early on that when my siblings are happy, when my parents are happy, when people, my friends are happy, I'm happier. And so I really kind of took to this idea of utilitarian ethics.
You know, most of us believe we've never met a sociopath, but research shows that, in fact, they make up, I don't know what.
1 in 25. So 1 to 4% of the population.
And many of them have very successful careers. Can you recognize other sociopaths?
Sometimes I recognize sociopaths, and it is kind of scary to think, you know, statistically, everybody has met a sociopath, but most people cannot ever recall having met a sociopath. If they met a sociopath, they didn't know it. And I think that has happened to me, too. I think I've met sociopaths and not realized it. I've also met sociopaths and did realize it. I think there's kind of ways that you can tell. They tend to hold eye contact, and then it kind of becomes a staring contest. If it's sociopath against sociopath, then it's just like really intense staring at each other for however many minutes. There are other ways to try to flush people out. Sometimes I like to bring up the TV show Dexter and ask them how they feel about things, about Dexter. And if I think a lot of times sociopaths are sort of dropping hints, you know, about themselves. They want to be discovered. They rarely flat out lie. They largely kind of tell the truth in ways that are not really going to out themselves, but they can still express their own authentic thoughts about something.
M.E. Thomas is the author of Confessions of a Sociopath, A Life Spent Hiding in Plain Sight. She spoke with N. Strange Champs. Serial killers are scary enough, but imagine a serial killer that can travel through time. That's the premise behind Lauren Bucus's new novel, The Shining Girls. And it could be coming soon to a television near you. Leonardo DiCaprio's production company has bought the rights. Here's Lauren Bucus.
This is the opening of my book, The Shining Girls. It's Harper, the serial killer, in 17 July 1974, and it's his first meeting with our heroine, Kirby. He clenches the orange plastic pony in the pocket of his sports coat. It is sweaty in his hand. Midsummer here, too hot for what he's wearing. But he has learned to put on a uniform for this purpose, jeans in particular. He takes long strides, a man who walks because he's got somewhere to be, despite his gimpy foot. Harper Curtis is not a moocher, and time waits for no one, except when it does. The girl is sitting cross-legged on the ground, her bare knees white and bony as bird skulls and grass-stained. She looks up at the sound of his boots scrunching on the gravel, but only long enough for him to see that her eyes are brown under that tangle of grubby curls, before she dismisses him and goes back to her business. "What are you doing?" he says, putting brightness in his voice. He crouches down beside her in the threadbare grass. Really, he's never seen a child with such crazy hair, like she got spun around in her own personal dust devil, one that tossed up the assortment of random junk splayed around her. A cluster of rusty tin cans, a broken bicycle wheel tipped on its side, spokes jabbing outwards. Her attention is focused on a chipped teacup, turned upside down so that the silvered flowers on the lip disappear into the grass. The handle is broken off, leaving two blunt stumps. "You having a tea party, sweetheart?" he tries again. "It's not a tea party," she mutters into the petal-shaped collar of her checked shirt. Kids with freckles shouldn't be so earnest, he thinks. It doesn't suit them. "Well, that's fine," he says. "I prefer coffee anyways. May I have a cup, please, ma'am? Black with three sugars, okay?" He reaches for the chipped porcelain, and the girl yelps and bats his hand away. A deep, angry buzzing comes from underneath the inverted cup. "Jesus, what do you got in there?" "It's not a tea party. It's a circus." "That's so." He turns on his smile, the goofy one that says he doesn't take himself too seriously, and neither should you. But the back of his hand stings where she smacked him. She glares at him suspiciously, not for who he might be, what he might do to her, but because she is irritated that he doesn't understand. He looks around more carefully and recognizes it now, her ramshackle circus, the big top ring marked out with a finger traced in the dirt, a tightrope made from a flattened drinking straw rigged between two soda cans, the Ferris wheel of the dented bicycle wheel, half propped up against a bush, with a rock to hold it in place, and paper people torn out of magazines, jammed between the spokes. It doesn't escape him that the rock holding it up is the perfect fit for his fist. Or just how easily one of those needle spokes would slide right through the girl's eye like jello. He squeezes hard on the plastic pony in his pocket. The furious buzzing coming from underneath the cup is a vibration he can feel all the way down his vertebra, tugging at his groin.
It's amazing, you know, we don't know it yet, but you've just set up the whole story in those first few paragraphs.
Thank you.
These two characters, Harper Curtis, I guess, and Kirby Mazraki.
Yep.
They are really the central characters in your story. Tell me a little bit about what happens to them after this day when she's a girl and he's grown.
Well, the pony in his pocket is actually an impossible present, because this particular event happens in 1974, but the pony is from 1982. It's a My Little Pony. It's Butterscotch. And he tells her that he's going to come back for it. And he does in 1989 when he comes back to try and kill her. And this is what he does. He has a house which opens onto other times, and it allows him to hunt the woman he defines as his shining girls through time across decades. And he comes to kill her. And for one reason or another, he doesn't succeed, and he doesn't know that she survived. But this completely overturns her entire life, and she becomes absolutely obsessed with finding the man who did this to her, turning the hunt around on him, and stopping him. So they're kind of two characters caught in twin obsessions. It's almost a death duel. And eventually he will figure out that she's actually survived and come back for her.
When did the idea come to you?
You know, writers spend a lot of time messing around on Twitter. And sometimes that pays off because I was bantering with a random stranger and I threw out the idea in the middle of a conversation. Hey, you know, I should write a book about a time-traveling serial killer. And I thought, wait, I really should. That would be great. I could do something really fun with that. I quickly deleted the tweet and I started writing the book on the plane. And I had this opening chapter come to me immediately as a very strong kind of central image. And I always know my beginnings and my endings. It's kind of figuring out the in-between stuff, which is where the magic comes in. But I knew I wanted to set it in the 20th century and look at how the loops of history come up again and again. You know, it's a time travel book. There are loops. There are paradoxes. But it's also about history.
I guess the time travel loops are part of the fascination of it. But did you know right away? I mean, were you planning to write a book about a serial killer?
No, I've never had a particular interest in serial killers. I'm not one of those serial killer junkies. I've watched a lot of serial killer movies, and I think some of the better ones do it very, very well, from Silence of the Lambs through to Seven. You know, I think a lot of what I'm doing, I hope, is kind of subverting the traditions of the genre, you know, and making it much more about the victims, who are normally just pretty corpses or bloody puzzles, and making it much more about the woman than the actual killer.
Well, and of course, in this case, it's not just a woman, it's many women. It's the shining girls. They are all shining girls, and you mean shining in a very particular sense, don't you?
I do. A lot of serial killers have a type. Ted Bundy went for a young woman with long brown hair and a middle parting. And Harper Curtis's type is that he looks for women who have a spark inside them, a burning potential. You know, there's a fire in their guts and he can't stand it. They're all kicking back against their social context in some way or another. He's driven to kill them because of it.
Does he have some particular experience, or is that asking you too much to know why he can't stand that spark?
Well, he stumbles upon this house and the woman's names are actually written on the wall, waiting for him. So it's kind of a play on time travel and fatalism, destiny. It becomes a kind of a puzzle that he's fallen into himself. But he was certainly a violent man before this. You know, there was certainly a precedent. This is just what nudged him through the final door. He was involved in World War I, and he was complicit in his brother getting very, very badly hurt. He's always been a bad kid, a vile, violent man.
One of the things that I suspect must have been very hard for you, though I don't know, is that you really describe these murders graphically. There is gory detail after gory detail. I guess it would have been hard for me. I don't know whether it was for you.
It was. And I think there are some people who have found the violence shocking. But you know what? It's supposed to be shocking because real violence is shocking. And I need you to remember that because we're so inured to death. We're so inured to violence. We're so inured to serial killers that I needed to jolt you out of that. And actually, I think a lot of that response comes from the fact that the deaths are actually quite emotional because they're from the woman's perspective. And you're with her at the end. You're not riding along on the serial killer's shoulder, complicit in the action, kind of getting off on the sick thrill of getting the knife in. You are with the young woman. And it's her shock and her outrage and her fear and how dare you do this to me. And, oh my God, he just stabbed me. And it's that reality. And I wanted it to be real because I think it's too easy to write that very glibly and to make death meaningless and to make it just another dead body. So it is supposed to be upsetting. I tried not to go into too much detail, but there are one or two kind of shocking lines and vivid imagery to jar you specifically.
Why, by the way, did you go to Chicago for this? You're South African, you can tell by listening to you, that that's the part of the world you know best. But you chose 20th century Chicago. There must have been a reason.
I specifically didn't want to write about apartheid. I have tackled apartheid in both my previous books. If you're looking at the 20th century, America just gives you a much broader scope. There's much more range to play with in terms of looking at everything from how highways have reshaped cities to how McCarthyism, you know, the Red Scare is an echo of the war on terror that we have today with paranoia festering and being used to erode our rights. And there were all these kind of loops and interesting threads that I wanted to pick out. Women's rights, the Great Depression, you know, all kinds of things. And if I had said it in South Africa, apartheid would have just overshadowed everything. And it would have had to become essentially about that. So I specifically chose Chicago because it was a city I'd lived in. You know, in South Africa, we like to think that we do things best, that we have the best corruption, and we have the best violent crime, and we have the best segregation. But some American cities do it pretty well, too.
Yeah. You also kept it in the 20th century, which is nice in a way because it gives you the ability to do things that you can research. It's not pretending to understand the future.
Absolutely. My previous book, Moxieland, dealt with a kind of near future under a corporate apartheid system. So I have played with the future before, but I think there's a thread in all my books about the ghosts of the past and the ghosts of history that come up again and again. I think it's a major theme in my work, something I'm fascinated with.
You never actually explain, do you, how the house functions, how it is a time portal?
I don't explain how it is a time portal, but I do explain why it is a time portal.
There's a feeling that it may not be, that these may just be the strangeness of Harper's mind.
It could be.
Okay, we won't pursue that one. What do you think it is about time travel that has such a resonance for readers?
I think it's fun. You know, I could have written Bill and Ted's excellent killing spree, and we could have jumped from killing cavemen to killing Shakespeare to killing Hitler. But I specifically wanted to do a more serious book which examined more serious issues, or I'd like to hope it's a more serious book. Wild conceits like time travel, or in my previous books, magical animals that attach themselves to criminals, or kind of a near future where we're controlled by our cell phones, which is not at all like our current reality. It allows you a way to play with current issues. And we have such issue fatigue. You know, I mean, every time Syria comes on the news, it's just so overwhelming. And it's so much to deal with. You just kind of want to change the channel. And as a South African, you know, the Oscar Pistorius case, you know, talking about violence against women, you know, it's just horrific. And you get sick of it. And you just want to change the channel and look away. And I think fiction, and especially inventive, strange, playful fiction, just gives you enough of a twist on reality that it makes it fresh again, that you can get into those issues from a different angle. It's like a distorting mirror which makes things more clear.
Lauren Bucus is the author of The Shining Girls. Why do you think we're so drawn to stories about fictional serial killers? You can share your thoughts with us on Facebook or Twitter. Or you can send us email through our website. It's ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. Coming up, Chuck Klosterman takes on a few villains. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Chuck Klosterman has been described as one of America's top cultural critics. He also writes the ethics column for the New York Times Magazine. So maybe it's only fitting that his new book is a series of suitably Klosterman-esque essays about villains. It's called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined. To the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon talks with Chuck Klosterman.
One of the essays in your book is called Easier Than Typing, and you start this essay by presenting a thought experiment in which you ask the reader to imagine that Batman is real. Can you tell me about that, Chuck?
Well, I think vigilantes pose a particularly complicated scenario for people trying to understand how we kind of feel about public figures who are in the news. And I say that because if you talk to somebody who is, you know, intelligent, somebody who sort of is thoughtful, and you say, is vigilante justice good or bad for society? They will immediately say, of course not. You know, we have these laws, we have a framework for how society works. You can't have people taking justice into their own hands. But then you give them a slightly more specific portrait of an incident that has happened. You say, in a city that's sort of, you know, dominated by crime, a person who had done nothing wrong, was sitting by himself, is confronted by thugs, and he ends up responding with more violence than they brought toward him, and he sort of is acting on behalf of society, that society is fighting back. Well, then their willingness to emotionally side with the vigilante just amplifies. And then it goes one step further, whereas we sort of learn these details about the vigilante what he or she is like, what their belief system is. The idea that this act may have been more personal than social, it swings back the other way. Then it's like this person isn't acting on, you know, behalf of the world. They're sort of acting as a rogue free agent. It has nothing to do with social justice. It has to do with a desire for bloodlust or whatever. So I was thinking, you know, about Bernard Goetz, because he's the clearest example of this, the subway vigilante in New York in the 80s. So I started thinking to myself, well, what if Batman was real, okay? And when I say Batman, it's like assume that there isn't this pre-existing knowledge of this character from DC Comics. You know, no one knows who Batman is, so no one knows what his motives are.
Yeah.
I was trying to figure out how people would react, and particularly how the media would react if a figure like Batman actually came into play.
And then that's where you go from Batman to Bernard Goetz. And as you touched on earlier, Bernard Goetz, even though he's a victim, the more we find out about him, the more he seems like a villain.
The initial reaction to those shootings was entirely in Goetz's favor.
Mm-hmm.
For, you know, about 3 to 4 days, he was a nationally adored figure because New York was just a cesspool of violence at the time. And it just seemed as though this is somebody who was sort of saying to the world, it's like, this is an unacceptable cultural status. We cannot accept our culture to be like this. But then when he was arrested and he started talking about himself and just showed no remorse over what he had done. And I guess there was maybe a social hope that he would be like, I hated shooting those guys, but I had no choice. And instead, he was more like, it was easy shooting them. It was easier than typing.
Hmm.
And then we start going back into his own life, and we realize he said sort of like racially insensitive remarks at a community meeting. And then we find all these strange details about his personal life. It turns out, for example, now he lives in an apartment in New York with a bunch of squirrels. He's become like an advocate for like the squirrel population of New York. Well, now he becomes marginalized as a character, and we no longer see him as acting on behalf of anyone besides himself.
So there's this slippery slope, or there can be, between a vigilante and a villain.
Well, yeah, I mean, because we know all this stuff about Batman the character, we know Batman is good. We know his motive is based on the fact that he sees his parents killed and it changes him, it traumatizes him, and he decides that he doesn't want anyone to experience that kind of trauma. But if Batman were real, of course we would not know those things. We would just know that someone is dressing like a winged mammal going around beating people up who have not had due process. I think that a lot of the people, in fact, who probably like Batman the most as a character, the kind of people who are really forwarding the import of the comic book mythology, would be the first people to say, this bat guy needs to be arrested. We need to get him off the street. He's worse than the criminals.
Yeah. It's funny when you said that you mentioned Batman as a winged mammal. I had this image, given Bernard Goetz as being a squirrel advocate, of being Squirrel Man now. He could be a Squirrel Man superhero.
I wonder what would have been the impact of that. I've always thought it was interesting that we don't see more examples of people trying to become literal superheroes. There are people who do this, you know, who dress up in suits and walk the street at night, but it would almost seem like that's such a part of our culture that it would become sort of a normative thing for crazy people to do.
Exactly. And I'd like to see that happen with villains, too. That would be nice. Maybe I don't know who it's up to do it first. Maybe the villains have to initiate it. I don't know.
Well, you know, it's a real mistake if you're a villain, I guess, to become a supervillain, because a big part of being a criminal is being unseen and not being caught. So, like, wearing Joker makeup does seem like a bad move if you want to elude prosecution. Yeah.
But with the cult of celebrity we live in, maybe that's your 15 minutes of fame there, but that's a good point you raised. Chuck, can you tell me about your own archenemy, Rick Helling, who you write about near the end of the book?
Well, I had this incident happen around 8th grade. It was a basketball camp in Fargo, North Dakota, and there was a kid at this camp named Rick Helling, who was, at least in our age group, by far the best player. He was physically imposing and more skilled and very talented. But at least from my perception at that time, an awful person, maybe the worst person I'd ever met. He was extremely egocentric, and he seemed obsessed with sex, which I know is a normal thing for an eighth grader, but I just found it very uncomfortable. And you know, he didn't listen to the coach, and he was always arguing with the referees, and he was just kind of a bullying figure that really stayed in my mind, you know. And then I remember him going to high school. He went to different high schools. He went to a Catholic school in Fargo called Shanley, and I was kind of in a small town. But he was a good athlete, so his name was in the paper. And then, you know, he ended up becoming a Major League Baseball player, which is the only Major League Baseball player I've ever known personally. So I follow this guy's career. I still feel the same way I did in junior high. So, like, I'm reading the newspaper hoping to see that Rick Helling got shelled. Like, I'm just waiting for him to fail. He wins 20 games one year, and I'm just so disappointed. And he pitches in the World Series, and I'm mad the whole time. Well, I write a piece for Esquire basically about this, where I make this passing reference to having this arch enemy, and then he retires, and I'm like, oh, well, I guess end of story. But then I find out years later, reading an issue of Time magazine in the dentist's office, that Rick Helling, this guy who I'd spent my whole life sort of viewing as the antithesis of me, my arch enemy, was pretty much the first player in Major League Baseball to stand up and take a stand against anabolic steroids. Like, no one listened to him, but he was the first guy to be on record going like, look, this is a problem, it's screwing the game up, and there's going to be consequences if we don't step in. And then, of course, now, in the wake of what has happened, everyone looks back and go like, oh, Rick Helling was this truth pioneer. So I just had to come to the realization that the one person I am on record for hating is probably one of the most important baseball players of the last 40 years, despite the fact that his success on the field was very marginal. His import was that he refused to allow something that was wrong to continue happening without sort of standing up and saying, we need to change this. So, you know, that's kind of my life. Like, the people I hate end up being the heroes.
Exactly. As you write in the book, then that makes you the villain.
In my own story.
Yeah. Has writing this book and your work as the ethicist for the New York Times Magazine changed the way you think about good and evil?
Has it changed the way I think about good and evil? I'm not exactly sure I really believe in the concept of evil. There's good and bad, but evil is something different. Being the ethicist has definitely changed my life, though. When you take that job, like, I'm not claiming to be the most ethical person in New York or in America. Like, the title of the job is the ethicist. It's just the name of the column. But I know it's not perceived as that way. It is perceived by other people as someone saying, I know what's right and I know what's wrong. So I'm super conscious of all my actions now. I was walking down the street the other day and I was eating something, you know, and I had like a wrapper and I rolled up the wrapper and I tried to throw it in the wastebasket and I missed. I kind of kept walking and then I was like, I better not do this. If someone sees this, I'm going to get fired. So I went back and I put it away. I'm always very nervous now of being seen as an unethical person. But, you know, that's not the same as being good. And that's part of the problem. Like, if I go through my life making sure I only do good things, but my motive for doing so is just to be seen as not bad, I don't think that's the same as being good for society. That seems like acting all the time. And I sometimes wonder if my good deeds are basically just performances.
Do you really think that, though? You sometimes wonder, but do you really think that that might be true?
I don't think I know. I don't think it's possible for me to know. Because a big part of sort of living a reasonable life is self-deception. We are constantly self-deceiving ourselves into believing that what we're doing is just or important or meaningful, that it almost becomes, well, it does, it becomes a second nature. It's almost like there's a shadow self that is constantly convincing us that what we're doing is being done for the proper reason or the proper motive. And I'm very distrustful of the things that I do. I try to be a generous person. I'm suspicious of my generosity, you know. Try to be an honest person. Why? Am I honest in a way that avoids a straightforward lie but is just like a twisted version of the truth? I can't be accused of straightforwardly making something up. I don't know. You write a book like this because probably you're uncomfortable with your own self. And I think that's probably true about myself.
Chuck Klosterman is the author of I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains, Real and Imagined. He spoke with, to the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon. Is there a villain, real or imagined, that you find especially captivating? We'd love to know who he or she is. You can get in touch with us through Facebook or Twitter. You'll find links to our accounts on our website, ttbook.org. Coming up, neurophilosopher Patricia Churchland answers the question, is genocide in our genes? As we conclude our hour on the dark side of human nature. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. When we talk about violence, the subject of nature versus nurture often comes up. Are we hardwired with the capacity to commit violent acts? Or is a toxic upbringing to blame? Or is it some combination of the two? Patricia Churchland has some thoughts on the subject. She's a pioneering neurophilosopher and the author of the book Touching a Nerve, The Self as Brain. Steve Paulson talks with her.
I want to talk about some of the specific issues that you explore in your book, Touching a Nerve, the Self as Brain. For instance, you raise the question, is genocide in our genes?
Mm-hmm.
What made you think about this?
Well, I think there were two things. One is that there is a kind of tendency when people see a behavior that is common to say, well, it must be in the genes. And very often the behavior in question can be highly modified because the brain is so changeable as a function of experience that the behavior is highly modifiable by the environment and by the way experience impinges on the brain. One of the things that you want to think about when the question of genes comes up is, okay, let's just take that idea seriously and let's roll up our sleeves and see what the heck is really there. Now, many people have argued that war is in our genes. So that was one of the cases where I thought, well, let's just find out what we actually know about genes and aggression. And that led me to this work on the fruit fly that I talk about. Now, you might think, well, a fruit fly, how, you know, except that if you can't get a simple genetic story of the relation between genes and aggression in the fruit fly, what makes you think you're going to get a simple story in mammals or especially in humans?
Yeah.
So the story in the fruit fly is that there are many, many, many genes that play some sort of role, unknown, in aggressive behavior in fruit flies. It's mainly in males who compete for females, you know, and they fight. You know, it's actually kind of interesting to watch. But it turns out that there are many genes and there is no simple relationship, that genes form these complicated networks with each other. And they interact with the environment to change gene expression, which also changes then what growth and development happens in the brain. So there's this wonderful interaction between genes, environment, and brain structures that remains to be understood and unraveled. But, you know, to think, well, there's a gene for mums to stay at home and take care of babies, or there's a gene for not having abortions. Well, you know, probably not. That doesn't work like that.
Yeah, and there's also been this effort to look to various peoples who are not part of modern civilization to sort of see, okay, so are they, you know, inherently violent or not?
Yes, yes.
You write, for instance, about two very different cultures, the Inuit and the Yanomamo, and they have extremely different behaviors, especially when it comes to raiding in war. Can you spell out those differences?
Yes. Genetically, the Inuit who live in the Arctic and the Yanomamo who live in Brazil, genetically they're indistinguishable as they would be from me. But the Yanomamo appear to be fairly warlike, and they go on these raids to neighboring camps and kill people and steal women and cause havoc and so forth. And male children are brought up to be part of that, and they dress themselves up in these ways that signify that they are warriors, and they learn to use spears and so forth. So it's really, you know, a part of the way they are. The Inuit, by contrast, probably because their ecology is so harsh and they have to be so careful, are not warlike at all. Now, they are certainly capable of killing others if they have to, but there is a cultural downplaying of aggression within the group. And it's really frowned upon. And as a consequence, people find other ways of easing tensions, of dealing with competition within the group and so forth. And when they come together with others in these big summer festivals, they manage to get along fairly well. Now, it doesn't mean that there's never murder, and it doesn't mean that they never kill one another, but they never do seem to engage in warfare.
And you're saying this is basically because of the radically different environments they live in, one environment being kind of Arctic-like, very barren, harsh, and the other, the rainforest.
Yes, let me just put it in slightly crude terms. I mean, in the rainforest, you've got lots of foliage and trees, and you can sneak around without being seen. Whereas in the Arctic, the settlements are spread out, and you're going to be seen if you go trekking from your settlement to the neighbors. Why? Well, there's no trees, and the dogs are going to set up an alarm, and it's very easy to see somebody from a very long distance away. So it would be hard to do any sneaking around. And it's also not clear what the benefits of warfare would be. I mean, what would you do? What's it for? Well, in the case of the Yanomamo, they would get goods as well as females, and they would feel good about the revenge for previous infractions. In the case of the Inuit, until very recently, they didn't really have much worth stealing. So there wasn't really much point in raids between settlements, but keeping competition and violence within the settlement at a very low level was of primary importance because you could endanger the whole group. And these people were, until very recently, always living on the knife edge of starvation. So to do stupid things like kill other members of the group who are good hunters is not in your interest.
You write about, I don't know if I'm saying this right, the Chippewyan people of northern Manitoba.
Ah, yes, yes.
There's a sort of a startling story that you tell. Can you tell us that story?
Yes, the story comes from a novel written by, oh my God, what's his name? Joe Bowden, called The Three-Day Road. And in the story, one of the events that happens is that not uncommonly in the north, when the winters are very harsh and the Aboriginal people like the Chippewa and the Cree and so forth had to struggle to survive through the winter. And sometimes they would be lucky and there would be game, and other times they would starve. And the weak, of course, were the ones who would die. In the story of the Three-Day Road, what happens is that the game is very low. People are on the verge of starvation. The woman who has recently had a child finds that her milk is drying up. And one night, she and her husband leave the camp and wander off through the birch trees elsewhere. She comes back alone in the spring with the baby, and the baby is very strong and healthy. Indeed to be wondered at, given the nature of the harsh, harsh winter. Well, it's obvious to everyone in the camp, with the husband gone and the baby and the wife looking so healthy and well-fed, it's obvious to them what has happened. And because cannibalism is really frowned upon for generations upon generations and well-recognized not to be acceptable, it comes to pass that she is rather shunned, and she sort of recognizes what ultimately must happen. And eventually, the chief of that particular group kills her by suffocation and then also kills the baby.
And for those of us who live in real luxury and are well-fed every day and never have to worry about starvation in the winter, this story can seem terribly cruel. But it needs to be put in the context of the ecology that the people had to suffer. And the fact that over many, many generations, it was very important that cannibalism not be acceptable. And it was also clear that if the baby was saved, it would always be tainted by the story that it had fed on its father's flesh.
That's one of the questions that comes from the story. I mean, this haunting, sad story. I mean, you certainly could justify what the mother did, but on the other hand, it's sort of horrific. But the baby? Why did the baby have to die?
Why did the baby have to die? And as I said, I think within the culture, it was felt that he would always be tainted, wrongly perhaps. But remember, these are small groups of 50 to 70 people. Everyone would know. And it would inevitably be passed on to the children and their children. Everyone would know. And he would never be treated the same. And he might himself grow up to be very corrupt. That was the fear. And it may well have been rooted in fact of some kind generations earlier where the story would be passed on and passed on. But the point that I kind of wanted to draw from this story, because it really did sear me, was that it's very easy to feel confident in the rightness of the moral practices of your own group, and very easy to criticize those practices of a different group, and that we have to not be foolish about accepting any practices as good as any other, but we also have to be very judicious about recognizing the role of environment and ecology in certain practices coming into existence, certain moral practices coming into existence.
Patricia Churchland is the author of Touching a Nerve, The Self as Brain. She spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you'll also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program The Beast in Me. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Sarah Nix. Special thanks to special guest engineer Brad Kohlberg. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.